listener production.
Hi, this is Paul McIntyre. Welcome to the MI3 audio edition. I've been a business journalist for 25 years covering the marketing, media, agency and tech sectors. In this series, we talk to industry leaders about the global and local developments that you need to be across this week. Well, if you're a client or staffer of one of the big five global marketing services holding companies, you might want to listen to this one, either for your career or the capabilities and smarts as a brand owner that these giants are developing or not in some cases. This is part two of our series with specialist US equities analyst Brian Weezer at Madison & Wall, whose focus is on listed firms and their marketing investment trends, along with the media and holding company sectors that service them. Last week with Brian, we covered the robust advertising and promotion budgets that big listed firms like L'Oreal, Unilever, Diageo, Ford, and others disclosed in their earnings calls in recent weeks, which contrasts greatly with the apparent advertising contraction, even recession, referred to by some media companies. But this episode is about the fortunes of the global holding cos, and boy, there's a lot happening. Brian's got a vault of intriguing insights we're going to raid today, starting with the earnings results from each of the big guns, WPP, IPG, Dentsu, Omnicom and Publicis. And the latter, i.e. Omnicom and Publicis, are breaking from the pack in growth terms, while WPP's outlook is unambitious and Dentsu the most troubled in Brian's analysis. IPG sits somewhere in between. Interestingly, the Omnicom and Publicis outfits are seeing market-leading growth, partly because they've been the most aggressive in principal-based media trading models, essentially arbitrage, where the media units of these holdcos use their treasury operations to buy advertising inventory from media on favorable pricing terms and then on-sell that to clients at handsome markups. Meanwhile, the big acquisition of data firms from Publicis in Epsilon and IPG's Acxiom have also proven smart moves for their growth contribution to the overall businesses that own them. And Brian says it shows up the strategic gaps of WPP and Omnicom, at least on data. But we'll also dive into Omnicom's $800 million acquisition of e-commerce outfit Flywheel, which another podcast guest we had on last month, Nick Manning, says we, and I quote, are witnessing the full-scale emergence of a new way to drive business and new marketing models, and this will have a profound influence on the marketing services industry and thus the agency world. We'll also look at the creative agency side of the whole coast, which is a mixed bag. Some are doing okay, others are in trouble. Most commentary around the international creative agency networks have them very challenged. So let's get to this. Welcome back, Brian, for the second time in a week, and you'll be getting sick of these pesky Australians, but we're going to ask you questions anyway. So shall we start, I think, with the top line, really, on who's doing best among the holdcos and why, and welcome back within a week.
Thanks for having me again. I have been an equities analyst, but I am not formally someone who covers the stocks. I do spend a lot of time studying the businesses of the agency industry, among other parts of the industry. Yeah, a subtle distinction. I'm focused more on the business than on its valuation. So the first thing to always point out is that Rashad Tabakawala, ex of Publicis, was correct. Agencies are cockroaches, not dinosaurs.
Right.
Now, I realize that may not mean the same thing in Australia because, I mean, creatures
you can't kill them, basically.
Yeah, exactly. But it definitely holds true because agencies have a tremendous capacity for reinvention, and we do see that regularly. You do see a cyclical element of one agency group doing better than another because one has adopted a set of practices that others haven't. And, you know, you can generally expect that when a successful path is identified, others will follow. We are definitely seeing successful paths in what Publicis is doing in particular, but also Omnicom, to their credit, is doing reasonably well, I think, despite certain limitations to how they've organized themselves. The common thread between them is that they are more focused on principal-based trading models, which I guess I'd add to your comments earlier. It's not necessarily that they're, you know, buying on more favorable terms or that's it's the old school arbitrage. It can be like an ad network in the form of Conversant, which people seem to forget that Publicis bought when they got Epsilon. Epsilon is not just a data firm, but Epsilon itself bought an ad tech firm called Conversant many years ago. And so you have that. And then, yeah, you do have the thing called PMX, which is the principal-based trading operation. It's hard to know how much you know, these activities drive the results. But the other thing that's tricky to analyze and difficult to understand, and I can't claim to be privy to how some of the mechanics work, but it can also be the case that in some cases there could be options involved or soft commitments, or it could be that the media never trades hands between the media owner and the agency, and it really just goes straight from the media owner to the marketer. And at the end of the day, though, marketers have basically decided that if they don't want to pay fees for services because it's so-called non-working spend, and they'd rather bundle it in with working spend, well, that's marketers' prerogative. We can argue about the pros and cons, but collectively, they are saying that, yeah, they kind of accept, if not sometimes prefer, that model.
If we get the top line, though, I think from your analysis, Brian, in terms of the growth or the results in the last quarter or of 2023 full year, we're seeing the likes of WPP sitting at line ball in terms of its growth. Omnicom's up 4.4, Publicis is up 6.3, IPG 1.7, Dentsu down 6.6, and in Australia, I note that it's down 10%. So just on that, how they've been performing in the last 12 months, what has been happening there? We've got the top line, but what's your take on why we got these two breaking from the pack, if you like? As in, Publicis and Omnicom.
That commercial focus has been huge. It's not just the principle-based trading, but it's definitely helped both of them, that they have been more aggressive than others. Certainly, WPP and Interpublic would claim that their exposure to the technology vertical has been a drag. And it's true that they do have a slightly higher exposure, not as high as, say, S4, but it's not the only issue. In other words, it's entirely plausible that you could have a single technology-centric client who happens to have cut a lot of spend, and that one client by itself could be enough to cause the agency group to struggle. But that is a big part of the weak story inside of Interpublic and WPP.
Brian, when you say that's part of the big story on terms of a growth drag, that is because they have been, I think WPP's numbers, 19% of its revenue comes from telcos, media, and tech. And it's that sector that has been globally pulling back. And then that's essentially what's impacting there.
Certainly they blamed the category. And it's you can't see the individual client spending trends necessarily. What agencies do disclose usually is their exposure to categories as they define those categories, which may not be defined exactly the same way across the group. It is true that WPP and Interpublic have greater exposure to what they broadly would call technology clients relative to others, but we're still only talking, you know, sub 20% of revenue.
Just on that, what is S4's reliance on tech, by the way? You said it was much higher. If WPP's the highest at 19%, what's...
Oh, it's like half. It's substantially higher.
Really, right.
One of the things, I don't have the numbers handy, but one of the issues, that it's been a double-edged sword for a lot of the independent agencies, the emerging newer ones, is that I think that where you're seeing a lot of, if you're seeing slower growth from some of the newer agency groups that have emerged, and it's not clear if they have, I can see it in the headcount numbers, employment counts, or when you see word of layoffs or whatever, it's possible that some of these newer agency groups that have formed in recent years are actually struggling because they are overexposed to technology clients who have been cutting. And what we've seen, you know, we can blame Elon Musk, because I think we started to last week, that I think he inspired many in Silicon Valley to look at their businesses with fresh eyes where they could. And maybe nobody wants to go as extreme as what Musk did with Twitter, now X. I think that a lot of marketers in that space did cut severely. Meta, certainly among them. I mean, significant cuts are evident in their disclosed numbers, despite the fact that they're making so much money from everyone else spending.
From advertising. So that the irony there is that they're making a heck of a lot from advertising, but not doing it themselves or cutting back.
Right, exactly. They're not dog fooding as much as they used to, so to speak, right? Eating their own dog food. And so you do see technology companies absolutely are cutting. It's just hard to tell how much that it's the sector cutting that's caused the weakness versus something else. And I think that there's an element of another thing that WPP and Interpublic have in common is that they have maintained more of a federation of a structure, right? Where there are more discrete business units versus Publicis and Dentsu, the two extremes, which have tried to become much more unified. Havas as well. where they've really blown up all of the agency brands for the most part. Now, this is working well for Publicis, not so much for Dentsu. Working well for Havas, I'd say. Dentsu has different issues, arguably because of the collapse of what was Dentsu Aegis into Dentsu, the Japanese business, and the imposition of the Japanese management team into the rest of the world. They're going through some growing pains, shrinking pains, I'm not sure what you want to call it.
I think they might like to call it transformation challenges is what they probably like to call it.
Well put, well put. But it doesn't mean it's the wrong strategy. And you could argue that they're better off than the alternative.
Which is?
Well, keeping a lot of different agency brands, hundreds of people with a CEO title and, you know, thousands of people who work for those people. The cost structures are higher. The politics are more significant. The bureaucracy can make it harder to do things, to execute on changes, to evolve and adapt in the market. And so there's definitely a lot of advantages to the internal consolidation, serious consolidation, like what, what we've seen with Publicis and Dentsu and Havas. We have not seen that at all from, or not anywhere near as much as probably needs to happen at WPP and Interpublic. Certainly, I made this argument, you know, in 2018, when we started to see the Publicis One strategy playing out, and we saw that, you know, Dentsu pushing in this direction. It seemed like the only correct strategy, because back to these things that clients don't necessarily care about, but say they do, it's like, is conflicts really a thing? Do clients really care about conflict? There are a handful who do, but are there enough clients who care enough that they would pay significantly more to be the only company from within a category working with a given agency group? Not very many. If you don't need those, have that conflict issue, you really can get rid of a lot of agency brands.
Just on the conflict thing, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the conflict is not an issue for a lot of the consulting firms who are often advising two or three different clients in the same sector on similar stuff. It's not an issue. We won't go there. We think it's that conflict thing is peculiar to agencies for some reason, and it's stuck, even though, to your point, maybe clients don't care. It still prevails, and certainly in this market.
As they say, two is a conflict and three is an expertise.
Yeah, right. Yes, good point. Let's just get into, Brian, then some of the divisional performances of these groups. Now, starting with data, right? You make the observation that both Publicis and IPG have done well with their acquisitions of Epsilon and Axiom, respectively, and that the data strategy from WPP and Omnicom hitherto has been sort of somewhat more, I think you say, unambitious. Just talk us through the data strategies there with the context that Omnicom's obviously done this really a big deal on and buying an $800 million e-com play, and we'll get to the implications on that. But the data strategies of each of these holding companies, talk us through that, Brian.
Well, let's clarify. It's not necessarily the data strategies alone that are unambitious for WPP. I think that you can look at the whole collection of choices as and the goals that they're setting for themselves is unambitious. Now, when it comes to the different approaches to dealing with data, it's not clear right now where there's a competitive advantage for anyone other than arguably Publicis. And you could argue that the data assets right now with Interpublic and Axiom and with Dentsu and Merkle should, if well managed, produce some meaningful advantage. Having a first-party data business at scale and being able to establish a roadmap should be positive. It's not the only way to compete, but I think that the premise I would argue is you need to be willing to make a meaningful investment one way or the other. Again, Publicis gets it in a couple of ways. The, you know, Sapient as an acquisition was far more expensive than it needed to be when they bought it. Whatever.
Yeah, what was it? What did they pay? Yeah, it was $1 billion or something.
$5 billion maybe. It was a lot.
Yeah.
It was substantially, it was nearly double where it was trading. I mean, it was a lot of money. And, you know, check me on that actual number that they paid, but I believe it was a premium that was, it was just remarkable what they were paying. Now, you could argue that for the right strategy, you know, that's not too much. Okay, fine. You can make that argument. I'd argue they probably could have gotten it for less, but maybe I'm quibbling. Nonetheless, it did provide them with a lot of the assets that are really, really helpful right now in terms of just capacity to build systems, build products, just do a lot of the IT services activities out there. I still, going back to ambition or lack thereof and WPP, I mean, I still look to Globant, which we haven't talked about yet, but is really worth paying attention to. Globant, which WPP did own 25% of, this, I'd say, crushing it on a relative basis. I mean, for a business with $2 billion or so USD of revenue, probably growing 15 to 20% this year, they'll probably grow more in an absolute sense than WPP, despite being a fifth of the size.
What do they actually do? It's a good point. Not on my radar enough, clearly.
Well, $2 billion of revenue, it's a lot closer to Sapient, and it's growing faster than Sapient. That's the best way to think of it. They are.
And WPP has a stake in that.
Services. No, WPP sold it.
Oh, this is the rival. That's right. Okay.
They owned 25% of Globant until about 2020 or 2019. And certainly Martin Sorrell was critical of that disposition. Now, you could argue maybe Martin should have bought the whole thing at the time or when he had a chance to do so.
Yes.
But I think that the bigger point is that when you look at where the growth is, and it's like this is the slice of the industry where the IT services firms are doing really well. You look at Accenture, Capgemini, there's a lot of growth to be had. And the sizes of deals that they're cutting are substantially bigger than typical agency of record relationships are, whether for creative or media. These are multi-year, you know, tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars of total value of contracts that are being cut. And there's a lot of growth to be had there. Sapient is able to play in that in a way that others can't. It doesn't mean that they can't invest in, they all have smaller businesses that try, but no one is really playing at that level yet.
And it's a big gap, right? So, and just on that though, I think Sapient's performance hasn't been hugely ripping versus some of the other stuff that Publicis has been doing, right? Epsilon's delivering better than Sapient, and Sapient's growth was sort of, it was low single digits.
Difficult comparables since the end of last year. I mean, there's noise in the numbers for sure. But the point is that it is a contributor to their overall growth. And I guess I make the point that you could have an IT services firm that's building businesses based on data without owning a first-party data. So it's not necessarily the only way to play data to have a first-party
data. That has been Omnicom's position, right?
Yeah. But I'm saying, and again, I think they've grown despite that. They tend to be pretty well run as far as I can tell. They've kept their silos. It works for them. I'd argue it's not a flywheel notwithstanding, it's not a very well future-proofed business. But, you know, they certainly have been investing in IT services with Credere, I believe was one of the transactions they made that was somewhat significant, and they've been investing in that. You can argue that they don't have enough exposure. Again, most of the agencies do not have as much exposure as they could or should have, probably.
To technology services.
To IT services, yeah. It's IT services that are associated with marketing. That's where this opportunity is. And I think you go back to the, again, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it was pretty obvious that Accenture was coming, right? Before they created Accenture Interactive, now Song. And there was this combination. Again, I still remember putting slides together in 2007, where it's like, here's these marauding armies of potential competitors. Again, even going back further, 2003, when I first showed up in the agency world, I observed that, wait, aren't we like body shops? Like, aren't we agencies? Shouldn't we be like having massive outsourced armies of people in, whether it's the Philippines or India or Colombia or wherever? And I mean, that was apparently not really a common thing at the time. And on the other hand, it was more common with today's leading IT services firms. But agencies were really, really slow to embrace that idea. And then when it came time to not just take the cost reduction piece, but the application of IT services to really driving growth, right? Not just cost reduction, but applying these things to using data, to using new customer experiences, the IT services firms were just so much further ahead. And I think even today, that's still a big gap.
Yeah, a massive gap still. I mean, I think to your point, some of them are trying, some of them probably maybe don't have that strategic nous yet. Would that be true? I mean, you're saying Publicis has done all right, but really even Publicis versus what the other IT services firms are doing, it's better than what their peers are doing, but it's still pretty small chops, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Sapient's a decent size now. Again, what's hard to really know, here's a fun task. Look at Accenture's claimed size for Song plus their other growth businesses. If you add up the three main growth businesses they like to talk about, those three growth businesses are bigger than all of Accenture because of double counting. Like they're giving credit for size and growth from different parts of the business. It's internally inorganic. And so it's hard to know how much is going on that's the same business just growing. Similarly, it's hard to know how much of the business is actually playing in the, you know, in the marketing services space. Like even Sapient, for example, they build trading floors like for financial services firms. That's a part of what Sapient does. And so I remember there'd be quarters where you'd get noise because there was a brokerage that they built a big trading floor for over a multi-year period of time, and that contract came to an end, and then they had a difficult comparable. I mean, it's a real business, but it's not what you think of when you think of marketing services and IT services together.
Yeah. Okay, and so there is that component. What do you see from each of them in the next 12 to 18 months on that IT services and data play, Brian? I know Publicis has something like 800 million euros slated put aside this year for potential acquisitions. It'll possibly be in that area. I don't know.
That's the thing everyone should be looking for, is how much are the companies willing to invest? This is an important point when it comes to assessing the history of the agency space. Now, these are US-specific data points, but I think that I suspect this would be true everywhere if the data existed. There's a common narrative that agencies basically didn't grow during the latter part of the 2010s, and there were a few factors that are associated with that. One was there was a report by the ANA, the Trade Association of the US, and K2 on behalf of them that was focused on transparency. That was one factor. You had competition from the IT services firms. That was another factor. You had insourcing, meaning marketers taking work in-house and doing it themselves. And packaged goods companies applying, you know, ZBB, zero-based budgeting, cutting spending further. And so a dominant narrative that I think even the agencies themselves believed is that the reason why agencies didn't grow, whether the US or globally, in the latter part of the 2010s were those factors. However, I was able to cut through some data in the United States using the Census Bureau, triangulating that with data from Ad Age for a like-for-like set of agencies. And then I isolated political agencies out of the Census Bureau because political advertising is huge and it's its own thing. And if you can back those things out, I could identify that the like-for-like agency industry in the United States for independence was growing by a mid-single digit level throughout the whole decade, consistent with the broader media industry. Yet the agencies, the holding company agencies, did not grow in the United States in those years. And so that so far kind of consistent with the dominant narrative, but not really. And then I started digging into the financials in ways I never did when I was an analyst. I looked at the returns on capital that agencies were producing back to shareholders. Basically, they accelerated. The amount of capital being returned to shareholders in the 2015, 16, 17, 18 period was dramatically higher. And basically, you had a business, an industry, the holding companies, that was disinvesting in itself, right? They were basically sending capital back to shareholders rather than reinvesting in the business. Should it be a shock?
Share buybacks, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Dividends, buybacks, etc. Should it be a shock that if you disinvest, you fail to grow? And the opposite should also be true, you'd think. If you invest, you grow. And so you had all these mid-sized agencies, a lot of them that have become well-known, you and Mr. Jones, Brain Labs, you know, pick it, your choice, that have been investing in themselves. And guess what? They grow. What a surprise. Invest and grow. Yes. Invest and grow. Okay, so they turned this around by 2019 when Publicis bought Epsilon and IPG bought Acxiom. And some of the numbers started to turn in a meaningful way. And then we have the pandemic, and that kind of messes things up. But I'm now absolutely, utterly convinced that agencies can grow if they are confident enough in their own prospects to continue to invest in themselves rather than providing capital back to shareholders.
A very astute point. And ironically, it's what they sort of admonish their clients to do, but maybe not themselves. A classic example of say, not do.
Well, and this is where the Publicis number that they put out there, which was a big number in terms of their planned investment. I mean, we need to see, if you want to see a vibrant agency sector from the larger holding companies, there needs to be more of that. Now, nobody says it needs to be the large holding companies that have a monopoly on growth. But it is safe to say that if you invest in an agency business, you will see growth.
Just on the indie versus network part, Brian, in the US at least, I mean, we're seeing a lot of indies in the Australian market, to your point, growing quite well. And there's a lot of energy back in with the indies, both in terms of the media side of it, also in creative and digital as well. That indie scenario globally, or at least in the US, what is happening there? Are they on the rise, the independents?
The data that I can best assess the answer to that question with is data from LinkedIn, where almost everybody who works in the agency world is on LinkedIn, has a profile there. And you can get data manually or otherwise by looking at their Premium Insights product, and you can basically figure out if agencies are growing. I've been building composites of agencies and other different kinds of companies just to try to track this sort of thing. What you can see if you look at the top, you know, couple of dozen or scores of them even, you see that there was a slowdown as last year progressed. Like, in other words, the year-over-year growth rates kept coming down and down and down.
For
and they
who?
Didn't decline. For the independents, for the large independents.
Right.
They didn't decline, but they definitely went from a very robust pace of growth in 2022 to really not much growth at the end of last year. This goes back to a point I was making before where I'm inclined to, and again, the premise is that you have headcount growth when you have revenue growth in agencies. I think we know that to be true. You only add people working for you if you've got revenue coming in the door. And if you don't have revenue, you cut your people. And I believe the data, it tracks.
That dynamic may change with AI, though, right? And the efficiencies that come out of AI, but we won't go there.
Not necessarily. I mean, what's tricky is offshoring. That's the bigger problem, because not everyone who works for agencies and who is based in the Philippines and Colombia, in India, is on LinkedIn. So that's where this does fall apart. But certainly where services driven, a large share of the staff will be based in, you know, the market in which the clients are based. So anyways, all I'm saying is that they did decelerate pretty meaningfully, and that's pretty consistent with the narratives I've heard out there from talking to people in the business who are working for independents. I wonder if they aren't overexposed to tech clients themselves, because, hey, if you and I were going to form an agency tomorrow, wouldn't you want to go after the marketer that's growing the fastest? So
yeah,
if you
right.
think about when these agencies were formed, they were formed to capitalize on these opportunities. So I'm not sure where the cause and effect is.
If we go to the creative networks, as I said at the top, creative agencies are supposed to be really, really challenged. And what's coming through in the numbers that you're seeing as with that narrative, if you like, Brian?
Yeah, I mean, creative networks have been struggling for a while, and I don't see anything turning that around. The problem is that I think that even though we know objectively that better creative produces better performance, and we also know that if you pay peanuts, you get monkeys. And although monkeys might put together in a room, might come up with some really good creative, I don't know of any actual agencies. The monkeys in Maud never actually had monkeys working for them, right? I assume not.
That's right. Yeah, you did. Okay. You did right. Unless you want to call humans monkey-like.
But the point is that we see marketers disinvesting from creative because they want to cut costs wherever they can, and they've been able to do so. They make fewer units at a lower price wherever they can. And the separation from spending on creative to the benefits and performance that can follow from more better spending on creative, that's a gap. So I don't see anything causing marketers to reverse course, at least not all marketers. Some marketers individually, sure, but as an industry, no. So creative networks are really kind of challenged. The AOR model they used to have is just, it's not anywhere near as dominant, if not common, as it used to be.
It's patchy though, right? Because I think in some cases, some of IPG's creative units were, there's nothing flying away here. We're talking 1, 2, 3%, I think, whereas others were backward.
Yeah, but
Have you got some specifics on that?
Well, no. I mean, you could go through the data points that the different groups have provided, and you can calculate there's basically no growth for creative agencies.
Right. Okay, just full stop, which then says, so...
Yeah, there could be share gains in any one year for any one agency, to be sure. But collectively, if you add up the numbers, there just doesn't seem to be a lot of growth.
So what's happening with Merkle and Dentsu? That was supposed to be a big one. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, Dentsu is really struggling right now. I think that the changes that followed from the, what seemed to me to be very abrupt, departure of Wendy Clark, it kind of all fell apart right then and there. And, you know, it's not clear to me, if, you know, they always said that this gradual evolution of Dentsu Aegis into Dentsu was always the thing they were going to do. But the way that that played out seemed oddly abrupt. And then you saw a lot of people leave. And, or in one case, a senior person agreed to join and then go back to Omnicom. And it's very odd. So, and then I think it's not unsurprising that when you have new senior people taking over that really aren't known by anyone in the other markets. I mean, Japan is an island unto itself, literally. And that doesn't mean they can't change it, but it is a problem because the market has been so separate from the rest of the world for so long. So now you're going to bring the most senior executives from there into running this, you know, this agency group around the world in a more hands-on way. Clients, I don't think they know these people as well. And so that's going to take time to deal with.
Well, and Dentsu has such a monopoly mindset in its headquarters right in Japan that, you know, they own a massive slab of the market. Taking that and then trying to be competitive in non-monopolistic markets, different game altogether.
I don't know if that's the issue. I think it's because, again, I think that they've known certainly that they don't have the same kind of dominance in any other country. I do believe that it's so much of the industry is relationship-based. And, you know, the fact that there is instability in management, that you had so many people leaving, means that if you're a client, you don't know who's going to make sure your problems go away. Mm-hmm. And the people who've come in, you don't know them well enough to know if they know your problems well enough, because you don't know them.
What's the difference between what Dentsu's doing? Because strategically, I think you sort of inferred it earlier on, strategically and structurally, the intent at Dentsu is right. What they're trying to do is collapse their silos and, you know, a bit like what Publicis is doing. It's been about managing the transformation, and it looks like, you know, Publicis has done a way better job than Dentsu on that, this stage at least.
Yeah, well, I mean, that transition, like, I think this would be true for every agency group, that there would be concerns about if you collapsed business units that you get a managerial flight risk. That's true. That's a risk that everyone has to take. And if you're Publicis, when they kind of blew up, does Saatchi & Saatchi even exist? Does Leo Burnett even exist anymore? I mean, yes, I know the brands exist, but practically? And I think that, you know, there would have been a huge risk if you did that at, you know, 15 years ago, if you said, yeah, hey, Kevin Roberts, no more Saatchi & Saatchi. Like, I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends on the deal that, you know, Merce Levy might have cut to say, okay, we're going to make it worth your while. And then the level down, right? To make sure that there's no disruption at that level. They had to take a risk at some point where they said, yeah, we're disinvesting in these operating company brands. And we're basically saying, it was always true with Publicis, they were more centrally oriented anyways, right? I think anyone in Chicago was always saying, the people in Paris are doing whatever they want to do. And so maybe that helped that people kind of knew that that was a thing that would happen. But it doesn't mean it's easy to manage. They did manage through it, though. They took the risk. They made the leap, just like Dentsu did. But the problem is Dentsu did it for Dentsu Aegis, and now you have another level doing it again.
Yeah. What is the biggest downside and upside for Dentsu?
Ooh, that's a good question. I also don't have a good enough feel for the individuals. They're just not as well known. And so that's the problem. Like, until you've seen them do it. Now, I guess if there's a bright side, it's that it's hard to imagine it getting worse. And so they've got their comparables get easier, that's for sure. They definitely have plenty of very, very, very capable people, some former colleagues, certainly across the company that I think very highly of, who are there. And so they certainly have the potential to return back to normal growth. But I don't know how to handicap it. I don't know how to say, 25% chance or 75% chance. And then layer on top of that, the normal cyclicality of winning and losing business. It's tricky.
So if we put aside performance of Dentsu at the moment, but if we put Dentsu and Publicis and perhaps Havas in one pot of a sort of a less siloed global organization, and then you have Omnicom, WPP and IPG, perhaps more siloed, which model's going to win? Can both work, or do you think one group will sort of start moving towards the other?
I think they can work, but I think the fewer silos, singular monoline businesses are far, far more efficient and more likely to thrive, right? It doesn't mean that it's not possible to have a true holding company with multiple businesses, right? The trade-off is always, if you have multiple business units and multiple leaders for businesses, that they're incented, they might be incented better. They might have a clear line of sight between making a decision and seeing an action come out. Whereas the more you try to consolidate operations into single holding companies, in some ways, these become more political as organizations, right? Because people have to collaborate. They've got matrices they have to think about in terms of reporting lines and responsibilities. And that's kind of the challenge that a holding company needs to manage in this world, meaning how do you balance, you know, decision makers and resource allocators with making sure a client gets what they expect, and then you do it all profitably and you adapt in an efficient way. It's actually more of a finance question than anything else, like financial management. Mm. Go back to when there's a lot of lessons still to be learned from the Publicis Omnicom attempted merger from now, what, 10, 11 years ago. And if you go to the breakup call where the Omnicom in particular, their CFO talked fairly extensively about lessons learned. And there were things he said at the time that really stood out to me, like they learned a lot about how to better manage global P&Ls. And he was, I mean, in essentially flattering Publicis and saying that they kind of figured this out. They figured out how to make sure that they could do this thing I just described.
Right, right. We talk about the holdco models of siloed and more integrated. Omnicom's done pretty much exactly that, right, with this $800 million acquisition of e-commerce outfit Flywheel, in that it's holding all its units as separate verticals, but the e-com Flywheel acquisition will go across all the businesses, as I understand what's going to happen there. Talk to us about that acquisition. I said at the top as well that Nick Manning said this is sort of almost a fundamental change to the agency model and marketing services, full stop. What's going on with e-com with Omnicom, and how smart a move is it? And I should say this in context of your comments last week, Brian, where you talked about this, despite all the talk about brand investment from client-side organizations, performance is driving a massive amount of this. And e-com fits into that with Flywheel, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially for marketers in fast-moving consumer goods, apparel, electronics categories, which are disproportionately dependent on e-commerce. One of the biggest challenges I think that every agency group has is talent attraction and retention. And it's been difficult, I think, for agencies to attract and retain talent that relates to e-commerce for many reasons. One is it's hard to pay as well as sellers do. And in a fast-growing space, that talent is more valuable on the sell side. And so when you have someone that's kind of on the buy side, and it's true for Flywheel inside of Essential formerly, and for PacView as an independent, and there's a few others, they manage to aggregate that talent and create, you know, viable career paths for people who want to specialize in this. And that has all sorts of advantages. So, you know, having gotten to that scale, now the holding company, any holding company that would want to own that asset needs to account for this talent management challenge. That's not going away, but it probably is easier when you have a large pool of talent in one place as opposed to a much more fragmented, smaller pool of talent. It's definitely going to be speaking to where there's a lot of client interest and client needs. You can imagine every single pitch, including marketers in those verticals I mentioned, FMCG, apparel, electronics. You'll have people from Flywheel involved, I assume, and that will help them on so many levels. You know, it's an interesting question back to this trade-off that every company has to make about how you resource people and business units. Is it better to keep something like that on a, you know, as a standalone business, so that whoever's running it can resource it? I guess Duncan painter in this case, whoever's running it can better connect decisions and resources to targeted outcomes for as a business leader versus putting it under someone else's business and maybe won't get the right resources and right attention. I mean, these are trade-offs that every business has to make, of course. I'd argue, though, that if you can manage the politics of matrix complex organizations and manage the financial management part of it, it's way better to be integrated. It'd be way better for Flywheel to be integrated inside of OMG in that sense. But there is this trade-off of, you know, clarity of management.
Does it signal, though, some bigger implications about the model, as Nick Manning talks about, both in terms of how marketing services works, whether media is as important as what it was when you've got e-commerce links direct into consumer purchases? Does it change, does it start to change how agencies and holdcos actually operate? Because it's
not necessarily.
Is it a different game?
Right? I mean, you know, I guess I should caveat that by saying it's interesting how healthcare agencies have become their own standalone thing pretty well everywhere. And it speaks to some of the unique characteristics of healthcare as a marketing category, that there is a separation from healthcare out of the media or creative agencies into a standalone vertical. I wonder, I'm just wondering aloud here, I wonder if you might wind up with something like that for the e-commerce sensitive categories. There are so many categories, though, called 70, 80%, that realistically, there isn't going to be much e-commerce. I mean, they're called non-endemics. So take petroleum, right? BP or ExxonMobil wants to, you know, run ads. Is a retail media network a likely place for that money to go? I mean, it could, but that's at the extreme. Even in the automotive industry, it's not that there's not a place for e-commerce expertise. It's just small. And it's unlikely to become dominant. But packaged goods, there's a lot of incrementality that follows from centering your campaigns around e-commerce or omni-channel sales.
So more fragmentation in terms of category management in these cases than what you're talking about, because there maybe. may be radical change required for those servicing consumer goods companies, but maybe not for, as you say, petroleum or auto.
Yeah, I mean, I'm responding to the idea that this is a critical game changer for agencies. To be clear, I think it's really important. Every agency needs to make investments in this space. Every agency group would love to have something like Flywheel, but is it necessarily the case that you're not competitive if you don't have it? No, I wouldn't go that far.
Mm. Interesting in that, and if we just go to say what Walmart's done in the last couple of weeks as well in terms of this acquisition of performance media outfit Vizio, Walmart, I think you say, is ad business now. It grew 28%, so $3.4 billion advertising business. This is from a retailer. I think you say it's perhaps the 15th biggest seller of ads outside of China in the world. E-commerce for Walmart was up 23%. So in that category of, you know, consumer goods and retail stuff, e-com is flying, and agencies and brands have to adjust to that e-commerce environment, though. So there is some evidence to suggest some change is required somewhere, Brian, if that's as ambiguous as I can get.
I'm saying that the impact, it varies by category, and there are some where there's a huge incremental impact from e-commerce on the business. And in other words, if let's just say you're in a category where 10% of your revenue comes from e-commerce and it goes from 10 to 12% in a year in a category growing 4%, it's half your growth. Mm-hmm. So it kind of matters in that sense. But we also need to be mindful of the scale, that it is more of a gradual thing in terms of the overall business.
Let's just dive quickly back into this principle-based trading model, Brian, in that talk us through then why that is contributing some additional growth for Publicis and Omnicom over the others. Why is that doing that? What is in there that's generating some good momentum for them?
Yeah, well, my observation, theory, speculation, combination of all of the above is that if you have the capacity to provide a client with media from your own book, that the client can then pay for that and consider it working spend. So clients who say they need to cut their non-working spend because they want to be able to say to their investors they're increasing their spending in working media, well, this helps them do that. If the agency says, all right, buy this much media from us, we'll give you some free services, or we'll include services at a discounted rate if you agree to do that, right? It's kind of inefficient. It's kind of, you know, just, it's superficial in some ways, but it seems to satisfy a market need. And so whatever complaints we might hear that pick your agency, usually Publicis, is undercutting everyone else, maybe it's because they've got a different commercial model. I mean, it's not unlike, again, sell-side equity research analysts, or maybe that's a bad example, but back in the day in the United States, and this could be true in certain countries, you know, you paid for trading. What you wanted was research. Well, it's not that different.
So you're suggesting that some of the I'm calling it arbitrage because I can conceptually get my head around it. You say maybe, maybe not. What technically that, but the margins.
It can be totally transparent too. It can be completely transparent in terms of what the margins are that the agency
contractually.
Gets.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right.
And it can still be principal based. Transparency and principal based those are not opposites.
But just to be clear, that is perhaps offsetting or subsidizing some of the other services because of what you just talked about. So what sort of markups are we talking about here typically, Brian? Do you know?
I mean,
on inventory?
I don't actually know, but I get the sense it could be significantly higher than conventional agency services. I mean, it's not hard to imagine that, you know, if you're the agency, you know that the client is willing to pay, say they're paying X for media, you know you can get media that will satisfy what they want for 0.5x. If you sell it, if you go get it and then give it to them for 0.75x, I mean, and you basically provide them with value that makes them happier and better off than if they paid X. What's not to like? And I get it. There's this notion that the client is supposed to think of their agency as an agent who only exists to, you know, favor the client. You know, the problem is that the marketers aren't paying agencies. First of all, it's one thing if there's a contractual obligation to do that, even if it hurts the client's interests, right? Because you could basically say if you've got a true agent relationship where, you know, the agency says, I will do something for you even if it's contrary to your interest because you've asked me to do it for you. Fine. But on the other hand, if the marketer basically likes the overall arrangement because it suits their particular needs, and I go back to this, it's a very cynical but very real view that the day-to-day clients know that if they pay peanuts, they get monkeys. They know that they need more services, more labor from their agency. They also know that their internal processes will not allow them to pay more for services. They need to pay for media. And if some of the spending on media gets them the services they need, they are better off for it if that's what the client wants. As long as the client, this is the bigger point, and this was what was missing back in 2016, that at that time, clients weren't asking enough, they were not asking enough questions. And in some cases, there were some agencies who were not doing a very good job of explaining, and some were obfuscating. We're now in a place where clients either know or should know the right questions to ask. They should know the trade-offs that they're making and getting. And if they accept those trade-offs, and it's a both parties are understanding each other, then that's a good place to be.
Yeah. We had an exec, a marketing exec from Samsung on late last year talking about how, you know, you talk about the digital inventory, and they said, you know, the growth and the metrics that they've seen in terms of their media efficiencies and optimization and so forth and their media buys, not converting to business growth. So despite all the stuff that we have that's attribution data and digital this and wasn't converting to the business. So I guess the bigger question here is, you know, you can be buying media off the books or on the books, sorry, and taking headcount out, but is the efficacy of what's being bought and traded actually working for the business? Because sometimes the agenda for a media agency in buying inventory might be because they can get a good deal. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's great for the impact it'll have for
but that can happen no matter what
sector.
That can happen no matter
what. But doesn't that actually entrench more of that challenge?
I don't agree with that. I think that marketers should invest far more in studying their brand health and studying the metrics that around their business health, a lot of so-called non-working spend. They're not doing it. That's the problem.
No. Yeah, that's right. And that's the root cause that's way beyond the time we got left in conversation. So Let's wrap this up, Brian, with a final sort of sense from you, sense check on the holdcos for the next year. I think what we've seen from each of them in terms of their earnings guidance is that WP is talking about 0 to 1% growth, IPG 1 to 2%, Omnicom 3 to 5.5%, as we said before, and Publicis 4 to 5%, and Dentsu's minus X, whatever that is. So just this year, what's your sense on what's how it's going to land by the end of the year?
It's a low to mid single digit growth year. I mean, it feels like it should be slightly better than last year. I mean, that's maybe the simplest way to put it. And, you know, you have to assume that when companies are giving guidance, these are numbers that they hope, if not expect, to beat. So it's if you want to understand what they think, take whatever the weighted averages and bump that up a little bit. And that's what at least you could expect that they collectively expect. But no, I mean, the industry should probably have a decent year. We're going to see pretty solid growth in media around the world. And marketing seems to be positioned to grow at a pretty rapid clip. You know, there's always a question whether or not the incumbent agency groups are actually going to collect that money, or will it go back to the IT services firms, right? Or will, and this is where there's a bigger threat we didn't even get to, you know, some of the products from Meta and Alphabet that are Gen AI based, Performance Max at Google and Advantage Plus at Meta, these provide great solutions for many marketers if they don't care about transparency. And it might be that the marketers who like those products don't overlap that much with agency clients, in which case there's no impact. On the other hand, you know, it's another set of tools for agencies to have to manage and be mindful of. And, you know, more realistically, include in the media mix. There's risks to the downside and there's opportunities to the upside within that.
Brian Weiser, I'm going to have to stop asking you questions because I'll keep going. I think we've got a good snapshot now of what's coming and the interesting competitive pacing that's going on between the 4 and 5. Some great observations there. So I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to leave you alone for a few months, but I will be back and we'll be hustling on what next. But thanks for joining, Brian, and we'll talk in a few months.
Great. Thanks for having me.
This MI3 Audio Edition was presented by Paul McIntyre. That's moi. Producer, Nick Slater. Music by Matt Dwyer. For more episodes, go to listener.com or download the Listener app and search MI3 Audio Edition to listen for free. Listener.